If anybody has lost a shawl, a black and gray shawl, I've got it up here. Oh, it's yours? Okay. I really liked it. I was just going to, you know.
Oh,
all right. It looks just like it. Did somebody, it's yours? Okay. It's Cliff's. It's Cliff's. It goes well with his blue shirt. For those of you that may have taken a little nap, Holly Witchy is blogging the conference on a website. She's been blogging as we've been speaking on www.musematic.net. So we are so high-tech this year, I just can't believe it. So email all your friends. They can follow along, too. This is the third session and the final one for today. And we're going to take a slight change in direction. For those of you that weren't interested in digital preservation, you can now get a little taste of documenting cultural heritage, which is a different type of preservation activity. And we have three great speakers who are going to talk to us about bring us case studies of documenting cultural heritage and the issues that they've had to address from three different venues. And I'm going to introduce all three presenters right now. Jane Sledge is from the National Museum of the American Indian. And in case those of you are unfamiliar with this museum, it's the newest museum on the Mall. Is it still the newest museum?
Newest built museum
on the Mall. And she's going to talk with us about some of the issues that actually were raised by Betsy this morning as the museum was developed, and as it developed its website, it realized that it had to address changing terminology. Terminology that sometimes was politically incorrect and other times was just downright pejorative. It had to be addressed with both the curatorial staff and with the general public. And she'll share with us both how the responses that curators gave and the responses that the audience gave, and then actually how they act, how the museum acted on those responses and what they did about it. Then Mark Loudon from the University of Wisconsin, has been working with a collection of materials from Americans who spoke in a German dialect. And he has created digital materials that then can be used with students, teachers, and the general public. What he's done is then explore how what they've learned with these materials might be transferred in working with Spanish language materials or other non-English language materials. Of course, this brings to the forefront preservation of other languages that would be disappearing, and how we might incorporate languages into working with other cultures. And finally, Anne Graham will conclude, Anne is our second speaker. She will be talking about the Olympic Peninsula Community Museum Project, and she'll share with us how a project working with museums, libraries, and archives, and the political and cultural barriers that they experienced and how they overcame some of these barriers to result in a very successful project. So first, Jane.
Okay, how'd you get the mouse to work? Perfect. Okay, we'll see if I could do this.
Is that your first page?
That is the first page. That'll do for the first page. So I've been documenting and working in museums for almost 30 years, over 30 years now, and I've been thinking about museum systems for a very long period of time, and I realize, and it's like a constant refresher, that a lot of what I knew and a lot of what I thought was right was actually, see if we can do it, wrong. That, you know, you think about, oh, we just take these catalog cards and we enter them into the computer and we do an inventory and we add on some collections management stuff. And now we add on this digital image and got a perfect computer system for our museum, and it's wrong. There's so much more. It's been something that I never thought would be a lifelong passion for me, but it is. And one of the things I've recognized recently is, and I don't know why I didn't realize this a while ago, is museum record-keeping systems are more than finding aids. They are, like, way beyond finding aids. They are stewards of knowledge. They are systems that present ambiguous, uncertain, and often incorrect information. Let's just say it. I would say perhaps almost 20 to 30% of the information in the National Museum of the American Indian system is wrong. So there you go. And we don't present the single voice of authority. We present multiple points of view, differing opinions over time. And we're, in a sense, a repository for a conversation. And that if you think about digital repositories are more than just the digital images. They are the contextualization of those images as well, and the conversations, the data, the metadata that's held about those images, but it's becoming more contextualized in a lot of different ways. And at the Museum of the American Indian, I've had the opportunity to really have an insight into the complexity of information. The Museum of the American Indian is a new museum in its vision of being a community center museum, but it comes from a long tradition of museums, of the open air museums, the Echo museums. René Rivard is one of the Echo museum people, and he had this diagram where you actually see all of this information about the residents, the sites, the landscape, the heritage, the collective memories, the individual memories, identity, cultural patrimony, what your visitors say, the traditions, and the environment. And it is a very complex piece. It is not just the object. It is life in general. And the example I'm going to talk about is the importance of preserving context and life in general. And I'm going to use an example from a lady named Marty DeMontano, who just retired after 23 years of work with the National Museum of the American Indian. She was the second Native American employee. She arrived at the Museum of the American Indian in 1985, a newly minted Master of Museum Studies person from Haskell University in Kansas. And Marty arrived, and the staff said to her, "Marty, what do you think about the Potawatomi exhibit?" And Marty went, and she looked at our Potawatomi exhibit, and she, in her own words, she would say, she had a flash when she saw the Potawatomi exhibit that she had been wearing her blouse backwards. But she went on to look at other exhibits, and she saw that in the Menominee, the blouse was also backwards. And so she thought, oh, the curators wanted to show the pretty side of the blouse, so they've put it like this. And then she got to another exhibit, and she saw actually a model wearing a blouse backwards. And she went, ha, you stupid curators. And so then she went to the curators and said, the blouses are backwards. And they said, prove it. And so Marty brought in a picture of her aunts wearing the blouses, and Marty herself actually owns 5 blouses. But this proof was insufficient for the curators in 1985 because it wasn't written in a book. It wasn't published by an anthropologist. It's true. It's true. They said that to her. And so it caused me to wonder, what were they thinking? What were they thinking? And I went and found the original catalog card. We have, at the National Museum of the American Indian, all of our catalog cards scanned. So you can actually go find the original catalog card. And this is in George Gustav Hai's script. Dates from about 1905. And it's the title of the card says everything. Woman's Waist. Pottawatomie, Kansas, collected by M.R. Harrington. And I thought, oh, I understand. No male anthropologist is going to ask a woman how she puts on her shirt. All George wanted to do was collect it. He just wanted it. And so then I asked our curator, Anne McMullen, Dr. Anne McMullen, what were they thinking of? And Anne said, no, Jane, it wasn't a male-female view on the collecting. It was that they actually thought that the Potawatomi and a lot of Native Americans were imitating the European pigeon front blouse. And she said something else that was really interesting to me, that people, the curators of the 1970s and 1980s, do not use or did not use images the way people today use images. I mean, we all go out to the web, we find our images, we draw upon our photo archives to find the original work. I think Anne was sort of brought me back to, this was not as prevalent in earlier research. And she also found for me a couple of images. The Lady in Red comes from the Josephine Tournay comes from the National Gallery of Canada and has been used in a couple of images, a couple of exhibits. But you can see this is not an Edwardian blouse. So I went back to our original registration information tracking system. And our registration information tracking system was designed to move about 850,000 objects from the Bronx to our new cultural resources center in Suitland. And it is the world's best object tracking system. But you can see that we still have the blouse backwards, and it's still called a woman's waist. It's not a museum information system. It's a registration move tracking system. And we're just implementing a new collections information system. And in our new collections information system, it's still a woman's waist, although it's been classified now as a garment. But we've added the native term for that object coming from Marty, which is a sachkin. And we can include other information, native terminology. And one of the points I want to make here is, as we talk about stewarding and preserving digital information, that unless you have a place to record this information in the right spot, you don't have it. And so one of the things we've been doing with our new collections information system is working on a very good information architecture to hold more information. And we've been really pushing our vendors and pushing ourselves to expand the information in our system so that it encompasses what we want to say and more. So it's both preserving the image, but it's also preserving the information and being able to preserve the information in the right way. Sort of what Chris Greer was pointing to, but I think we have a long way to go in our information architecture. Also, one of the things George Gustav Hyde did that is sort of endearing, but is one of the reasons why we have so much wrong information, is because he would go into, say, your living room and offer you, a poor Native American, $5, a fortune at that time, for everything there, and he would buy it. And then he would catalog it as coming from where you are, Washington, D.C. And he did not have the concept of trade, inheritance, or the movement of objects through time, the provenance. And so in our new database, we have the ability to talk about the culture that created the object and the culture that used the object, and giving us more diversity. And actually, we do have a digital image of the front of the blouse and a digital image of the back of the blouse. And we actually have the ability to put in more images in our data set that we can have the catalog card as part of the record and related images. And we have the ability to group individual records as part of groups and say more about those groups. And one of the things that we're also able to do is put in URLs and go out to additional information. And this is a website. Marty actually knew the lady who has prepared this website and provided this information about the Potawatomi blouse so that we can incorporate this into our website. And I've been for a while now talking about sort of this importance of shared information, that there is no way in the whole world I can ever have all the information that I want to have about my object in my record, that actually making collaborative links, even within our existing institutional records, not just in the websites, but in the institutional records, of showing additional information is really important to us. And one of the things at the bottom of the slide, which you're not able to read, is my grandmother told me that her grandmother used to use the big collar for a hood when it was windy. And it's the storytelling nature of what makes an object, just like I've done here with you, really interesting. That is what a museum is about. It's the civic engagement, which is a fundamental principle and value of NMAI, where we bring it into all of the ways in which we act in the and try to bring resources together. And one of the things I did was try to explain this problem that we have about correct information to our board of trustees. And I showed this example, and the one board member spoke up. And we have a significant Native American membership in our board of 25. It's about 15 right now. But one of our non-Native people said, well, what if it's wrong? And I think that that's where we just have to loosen up a little bit about this conversation, is we're not, as Ken Hammer once said to me, the voice of God. We are a facilitator that enables dialogue. And that's what I think is really interesting about museum records, is that museum objects do not come with a title and an author and a publisher on them normally, unless they're manufactured objects. But for a large part of a collection like the National Museum of the American Indians, it's a collection that has arrived, for which we have these catalog cards, for which we have a very limited data set, and which, to actually make interesting to you, the public, depends upon our relatedness with Native Americans and Native Americans' ability to recontextualize these objects and speak for themselves. So one of the other things that's been intriguing me recently, and I know about the Middlebury College in Vermont and the discussion about the authority of Wikipedia, but it has occurred to me that when I want to know about the Potawatomi in short form, I will go to Wikipedia. And that instead of doing my own record about the Potawatomi, that it might be better to actually work with the Potawatomi to engage them in maintaining their own Wikipedia records about themselves. That Wikipedia as well is a modern tool for civic engagement. It's not necessarily right, but it is a useful tool. And that if communities were participating in Wikipedia and correcting and being part of that discussion, it would be a really important tool for their representation. And when I started to think about what would be a museum information management system for the National Museum of American Indian, I held some community-based discussions and asked the communities, what did they expect of us? What did they want? And it was a harsh meeting where people told me to my face some things I didn't want to hear in terms of sort of being really frank about what's important to them. But it is actually in that frankness that was the gift that they gave to me. Because I'd gone to them and said, oh, I'm Miss Large-Scale Collaborative Project. And they said, Jane, large-scale collaborative projects are grandiose and empire-building. The Hopi want to know about the Hopi. The Navajo want to know about the Navajo. We want our projects to be local. We want them to be for us. We want to represent ourselves, and we want control over this information. And we want your information for our own purposes. So those have been the guiding principles from which we've been developing our information systems. One of the things we really value in this is the tool, a tool set, a broad-based tool set for collaboration. Here's a group of people interacting with a conservator and a curator. It's a generational group with an elder, young kids, and they're talking about this object. This is our opportunity to document this object. And so this is a lot of what we're doing internally, is changing the nature of our documentation to be a collaborative discussion. And I've been, in my thoughts, at the bottom of this slide, we have a very good technical infrastructure in the museum. We have our foundation applications, our collections information system and our digital asset management system. We have group reservation systems, we have fundraising systems, we have a multiplicity of foundation-building systems. And then what we've also put into the mix in a prototype sense that isn't like something to talk about publicly, but I will, is our metadata repository. Because our metadata repository enables us to bring together diverse tool sets, records, from not only ourselves but from other institutions, and to also be a staging area in which we can hold information that may not be ours to put in our collections information system, but may be appropriate, and we want to use it in our web and in our interactive exhibits and in our publications. And so that what I see is like a spiral, call it the spiral of knowledge, of community-based efforts, Native Americans, scholarly researchers who come to work with us, our own internal researchers, people who work on our publications, our exhibits, and our web. And one of the things I've spoken about previously is we did an exhibit on baskets and also an exhibit on made of clay, and our curators did an enormous amount of work. We have lovely websites for these exhibits, but none of that information went backwards into the collections information system. And so we have to develop a different mindset in the museum of this integrated approach where everybody is responsible for adding information into the collections information system. And when they develop the exhibit, develop the labels and the wall text, all of that too is done in the collections information system. So one of the things that I realize now, this comes from André Malraux, Museum Without Walls, and he's talking about this changing nature of museums where objects are contextualized, and that the original creators who used this object for their own purposes did not think about it as a work of art. It meant something to them spiritually. It meant their grandmother had cherished this object from her grandmother, which is a whole different context in the way we see objects in most museums today. And that museums were changing. And he said, And I love his quote. It's difficult for the fish to envision the outer aspect of his aquarium. And that's where I think we are today in our information systems, that we're sort of pushing against things, and we're thinking about things, and we're demanding more of our information systems, which is really great. But we haven't seen the end of this change. Thanks, Liz. That's it. Thanks.
So, hi, I'm Ann Graham, as Liz introduced me earlier, and I'm here to describe a community-based digital archive project and to share with you the lessons we learned while doing this project. This is a real nuts and bolts case study. I hope there are things here that might be useful or applicable to collaborative projects in your life or in your future. Some of you may say about some of my points, however, that I could have told you that. And yes, some points will seem obvious, but as they always say, hindsight is 20/20. First, a little background. Back in late 2003, our grant from the IMLS began. Together with people and organizations on the remote Olympic Peninsula in Washington State, we set out to create an online museum to showcase the rich and diverse histories and cultures of that region. Specifically, we began the task of enabling the community members to curate, digitize, and describe who they are. The project is now finished, and it contains over 12,000 digital objects, including mostly images, but also multimedia, manuscripts, oral histories, and 9 exhibits. The end product is a website with no brick-and-mortar component. It is only digital, and often there is no public access to the original photograph or artifact because it lives with individuals in their family albums in their attic. So it's a neat way to unearth things which would never have made it to the public eye pretty much in any other way that I can think of. This project turned out to be really rewarding, and it made the community happy and proud. The site is interesting, useful, and rich, but it was really hard to do. I'm going to share with you the top issues which come to mind when I look back at our processes and procedures. I see things that we did right, things we did wrong, things we were just not expecting. We decided to share this information, the good, the bad, and even a little ugly, for the benefit of similar projects taking place now and in the future. If I only knew then what I knew now. For those of you not familiar with the northwest part of the country, this is a diagram of where we're talking. Farthest northeast point in the lower 48s. And the communities that we are working with are up on the upper left side at Forks, and they're all distant from metropolitan centers. It takes 4 hours plus a ferry ride to drive from Seattle to Forks, Washington, which is the center of the region targeted by the project. A good communication plan was a key factor in seamlessly integrating all the efforts that were taking place concurrently. In Forks, digitization was happening, and in Seattle, metadata creation, web design, site hosting, and administration were all taking place. Forks itself is a very small town, about 1,000 people, and people outside of town are physically remote from each other, and the area on top of it is economically depressed. Other travel factors include the range of roadless mountains in the middle of the peninsula, and also the fact that some parts of the peninsula get 13 or more feet of rain a year. It does things to roads, like breaks them. As is shown by this cartoon, varying interpretations of history and culture are always possible. The project focused on material selected by community members of varying backgrounds, which allowed each local group to determine how they would be represented. We wanted the partners to speak with their own voice and to tell their own story through their selection, their metadata, and their exhibit creation. First, I want to discuss some overarching lessons that we learned. some of which are painfully obvious in hindsight. It took a long time for word of the project to reach everyone, and longer still to generate the community's trust and excitement, which is the only way that participation could happen. Before the grant was submitted, all partners had signed partnership agreements. But those agreements were not very detailed with respect to the work expected of each partner. This meant that there were differences in expectations down the road. And when push came to shove, it ended up that the UW ended up kind of filling in the gaps. Permission agreements, they take a long time to create, negotiate, and move through chains of command. The tribes took even more time because they are sovereign entities and because of different concepts of ownership. Individuals, it was interesting to note, signed readily, some of them without even looking at the paper. The community liaison, who was our man on the ground in Forks, we found it really needs to be someone that the community already knows and trusts. And he ended up being a member of the community, having lived out there for most of his life, was already pretty well known as a teacher and kind of a man about the region. He'd held many jobs. And he also had done a lot of work with the tribes, the three tribes we worked with, independently, having to do with digitizing recordings of language and songs. So he luckily already had a lot of trust from the tribes. People don't really want to entrust a stranger with their family albums. Trust is even more essential when we were working with the tribes and the Latino populations. The community liaison also can't simultaneously manage the project, oversee production work, and meet with the public. He had an open-door policy, and he was constantly being interrupted, and he was originally supposed to be the project manager, and really kind of no management was forthcoming. Instead, we all found that his meeting with partners in the public and directing scanning operations left no time for management. We were planning to use volunteers to do much of the routine work, but really not many volunteers came forward. In such a small town and a small region, we found that the people who were already of the volunteering mindset already had full plates, and that since they were they ended up being the same people who were already doing most of the work on other local efforts. So they were kind of stretched thin. I found we really needed to put a lot of effort into educating the community about the value of metadata. Partners didn't understand the importance of metadata to describe their images and the criticalness of metadata to be able to find them in the online collections later on. Sometimes no metadata at all was available, and in other cases, it took a great effort to assemble. So even though we held workshops, a series of workshops, either people didn't come or they didn't have the metadata to give or whatever, but we ended up getting very little. The partners all have an ongoing opportunity, however, to submit new or corrected metadata to the website now and into the future. It's an open-ended invitation. We found that getting metadata after the images had been submitted doesn't work very well, but we did have success with community roundtables or slideshows. There have been upwards of 30, probably more than that, given now, all free, open to the public in the evenings, and we were hoping to gather metadata from those slideshows where people would speak up and say, oh, that's my aunt so-and-so, and that was when she was around 25, which would put it in the year 1914. So that wasn't very successful. We were surprised. We didn't get much metadata, but the benefit of those slideshows was a tremendous community involvement and excitement building, and it really got the word out probably more than any single activity that anyone did to get participation from the individuals. We found we need to pay people to do scanning and digitization, and we can't expect volunteers to do this job. It seems obvious, but we all know that scanning can be a boring job, even if the images are really spectacular. Volunteers just weren't interested in sitting there very long without pay. Funny that. Another obvious thing, allocate extra time for everything. Well, we weren't really aware of it, but time really does run at a different rate in a rural community, and we called it Peninsula Time. I'm sure there's a name for it everywhere you go. Deadlines were sometimes completely unheeded. As an example, after the passage of the last deadline to submit new materials, partners kept trying to submit more. The community liaison estimated that twice the amount of materials as is contained in the whole entire project right now was brought in after that deadline. We had to turn them away. But they are invited to submit it without as much help this time around. I mean, the doors are open. We can. I'll talk to you in a minute about the sustainability of this project. There were issues having to do with beliefs and assumptions. Patterns began to emerge with respect to expectations, beliefs, and assumptions. You know the adage that you should know your intended audience before you create a website. We had to keep reminding those who submitted content that the web audience is national and global. And my theory is just that the folks on the peninsula are so used to being isolated that they are not in the habit of thinking on a larger stage. I think that they're used to thinking locally because that's where their help and support all comes from, is from each other. So, I mean, this is gross generalization, but I could tell by the kind of metadata that was submitted, everything from the assumptions that were made that you would already know, you know, the lineage of this person or, you know, the abbreviations used, that kind of thing, that they weren't thinking about a national and global audience. Also, the concepts behind exhibit design, especially for web display, was very difficult to convey to participants. Intensive coaching was required to get an organized and coherent web-based story from partners. Writing exhibits ourselves, meaning by the UW, went against the spirit of the grant, so we tried our hardest to get the community to participate. But in the end, a couple were written by the UW, although they were approved by subject experts on the peninsula. We found that non-professionals do not want to do selection because they're often family photo albums and every picture is important to them. Even with training on what selection is about, why it's important, we just kept getting an entire album given to us. End of story. And we also found that image selection cannot happen while scanning is taking place, and we did try that too. Selection can really only be done by somebody pretty familiar with the collection, and the person at the scanner was not that person, usually. There's always some hidden landmines in the form of buried resentments and quiet feuds. That's not uncommon either. I've since heard that it's not at all uncommon to find distrust toward a university or entity perceived as elite, and we certainly ran into that as well. Now I want to spend a few minutes talking about each partner and some details of our collaborative experience. I'll start with a national park. Well, we all know that the national park system is chronically understaffed and underfunded. And while the Olympic National Park maintains a fine archive and library, they made clear from the outset that they could contribute images, but that is all no staff time at all. The Olympic National Park provided the highest number of images of all of our partners. Also, metadata was very incomplete. There were almost no dates available, for example. Some of our workarounds were that the project staff and students helped scan all of their 4,000-plus slides. And to get metadata, we started with a data set from the National Park Service's Past Perfect database. But this data only covered a fraction of the images. We then sat down with the photographer of some of the slides of flora, fauna, and landscapes and had him state what the picture was as we quickly flipped through the slides. That took a few afternoons. The Forks Timber Museum is a tiny museum owned by a man, a guy and his wife, and there were some internal problems inside the board of directors. We heard later that it was because of an old resentment toward the University of Washington because of its research leading to the listing of the spotted owl as endangered, which in turn led to the curtailment of logging, which then led to the economic downturn and kind of the end of logging as a lifestyle out there. The board of directors of the museum were not in agreement, therefore, as to whether to participate in the project. So one, the only paid staff member, who was also a board member, the wife, decided to act on her own to participate despite the internal disagreement. So the participation level was not optimal. The metadata for all the images which were submitted for inclusion came on 3x5 cards and needed to be hand-transcribed. The library system on the North Olympic Peninsula couldn't sign our permissions agreement because they couldn't indemnify the UW and say that they knew that all items were in the public domain or that they own the copyright for them. This was especially true for the collection that we concentrated on, the Kellogg collection. A local man rather indiscriminately collected published and unpublished copies of photos from around the peninsula, often without any attribution to or permissions from the original photographer. But these are valuable pictures. They were the best of the best. And so the library system on the peninsula now owns this collection, and they were understandably leery of posting these photos to the web. By creating our own memorandum of understanding, the university and the library system agreed to a way around this, which consists of, okay, we'll throw away all the pictures that have a date in the metadata of 1923 or after. Then we'll review the photos for content and try and make our best estimate as to what time period, if it was 1923 or before, we'd keep them. And then lastly, agree to remove from the web any photos which are challenged as being under copyright, no questions asked. We've had not a peep. So far, they remain orphan. As with the National Park, no library staff was available to participate in this project, so UW staff and hired students performed the digitization. The Ho tribe, this tribe is tiny. It's a teeny tiny, tiny tribe. there is almost nobody to come forward and work with who was consistently there. So there is one primary elder who participates in activities within the broader region. She, in fact, was the initial instigator of the idea for this project. However, she's spread very thin and doesn't have the time to do all the work necessary to participate in this project on behalf of the tribe. And the people she brought forward with her were not consistent in showing up for meetings and stuff. So we didn't end up getting very much in the way of participation from the Ho, but we do have some images that came from other sources, which I'll discuss in a minute. The Quileute Reservation, or the tribal situation, is similar, and it was compounded by a complete change in tribal government midway through the project. So we had to renegotiate the permission agreements, and we never got enough steam rolling before the project ended to get a sizable contribution. But again, we do have some Quileute images and artifacts from other sources. In the end, those sources from which we got images were the National Museum of the American Indian, Museum of History and Industry in Seattle, and the Special Collections of the UW Libraries. Individuals from the town were keen to participate once they felt sufficient trust and excitement about the project. I did sense some competition, so if Betty put something into the collection, well, I want to have some stuff in there too. So that was great. That was kind of neat. we didn't really encourage it, but it was a nice little generated thing. Again, metadata was almost non-existent, and there was no selection. The Hispanic community, they are a shy bunch of newcomers to this area. I don't think there were anybody of Latino descent in the area before 20 years ago. And they fairly much operate kind of under the radar in the community. And gaining their trust is the only way we could have gotten anything contributed. We have the situation, how we got around that was we enlisted the ESL teacher at the community museum who was a trusted ally, even though she's not... she's actually Iranian, but they know her and love her and trust her, and so she advocated for the UW and helped build trust. And she actually went so far as to get a friend of hers who's a professional photographer to come around and photograph folks, contemporary photographs of people at work. And that was really, they are incredible images. They're very beautiful and very interesting. I have to admit that there was a veil. I personally didn't meet anybody in the Latino community because the ESL teacher kind of was a stand-in, an intermediary between the university and the population. So you know, I can't say a whole lot about how she did it, but I know she did it, and we found the right person. We had some great smooth sailing with some partners as well. It was just a... Okay. I better hurry up. Oh, I'm almost done. Okay. these three entities were all professional museums. They used the project as a teaser to entice foot traffic to their brick-and-mortar museums, and they were excited to have a way to get items online and begin participation in some sort of digital program. They were also excited to procure digital versions of artifacts. So these guys were all super helpful. They knew what they were doing, but it was partly because they were large and already professionally in the museum business. So come visit us. Oop, that was the slideshow.
Liz is going to go ahead and do my presentation.
There we go.
Thank you. From one UW to the other, University of Washington to the University of Wisconsin, I'm going to be talking about the American Languages Project, which has run for over 3 years now through a national leadership grant through the IMLS. We were awarded it in 2003, October of 2003, and we were able to, the support of the IMLS grant allowed us to leverage support from a number of other funders once the project was underway. And that's one of the most positive, tangible benefits of the IMLS grant for us was, as I say, this kind of leverage, not only the cachet of the grant, but the leverage in coming to other funders for, in some cases, rather small amounts of money, but things that may not have been at all possible without the generous support of IMLS. So we were able to stretch our budget in such a way that we applied for a no-cost extension to take us another 8 months to the end of the project, so running through June 30th of this year. The project partners are all on the UW-Madison campus. In terms of people that organizations, institutions that have a direct involvement in the project itself, but we've been partnering informally as far as focus groups and that sort of thing with a number of community organizations and especially schools. The four partners are the Max Kade Institute for German American Studies, which is linked very closely to the second partner, the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures, which was founded just about 5-6 years ago through a seed grant through the National Endowment for the Humanities as one of 10 regional humanities centers covering the Upper Midwest. Both the Max Kade Institute and the CSUMC, that's the acronym for the Center for, it's hard to answer the phone saying Center for Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. So you say Upper Midwestern Cultures or CSUMC. These are parts of the College of Letters and Science within the UW-Madison, but they're not teaching units. We are research and outreach units, and so we promote research, scholarly research within the university and certainly with scholars across the globe, but just as important is kind of going outside of the ivory tower to the community within the spirit of what's known as the Wisconsin idea, the idea the underlying philosophy of the university, which is that the boundaries of the university are really originally the boundaries of the state and are really the globe. In other words, it's very, very important to disseminate knowledge that is generated within the university to communities. The third major partner is the Dictionary of American Regional English, which some of you may have actually seen in sort of hard copy form. This is the longstanding, now 40 years in the making, reference work on English dialects, regional English, spanning all the lower 48 states now, including also Hawaii and Alaska, and across various ethnic groups, notably African-American vernacular English vocabulary is also well documented in DARE, that's the acronym there. This is also essentially a research project that's closely associated, not surprisingly, with the Department of English. The four of five volumes have actually appeared in print through Harvard University Press. The fifth volume, SK to Z, will appear next year. And so the project is very close to completion. And then it's sort of like bridge painting. By the time you finish that, then it's time to go back to A and start editing things again. And then the fourth partner on campus has been the Mills Music Library, which is a repository for our purposes very, very important collection of ethnographic field recordings made, especially by Helene Stratman Thomas, which are housed also in the Library of Congress, of ethnic music, so spoken word, but also musical recordings. There are literally tens of thousands of 78s that were made at little itty-bitty recording studios, and especially in the upper Midwest, but we have things from far afield as New York and Los Angeles that also document local culture through the prism of ethnicity and especially language. Now, I'll show you a few pages from the website, and I don't expect this to be an optometric, ophthalmologic, whatever, examination, so I won't expect you to read this here. But this is an example of our website, the American Languages website, and I'll just kind of guide your eye a little bit to some of the things, the menu, if I can get the mouse up here. There we go. Okay, up here we first have the English dialect section, and the material that's going to be focused there. And these are things that we're generating right now. The sound clips and the interpretive essays. These are materials that will be available within the next month. The German dialect section, which is the one that's the most advanced, and I'll be showing examples of that today. Is based on the holdings of the Max Kade Institute Sound Archive, which covers, I'd say, a couple of thousand recordings extending into several thousand hours worth of material, the earliest going back to the 1940s, and the oldest speakers who were interviewed in the 1940s were born in the 1860s. So this is a time depth that goes way, way back. The overall definition of a material that we use for the American Languages website and project is that these are indigenous varieties of language that are not spoken by first-generation immigrants. So they would be at least the second generation, so one generation after immigration or beyond. So we're talking about heritage languages. So we're not focusing on materials or interviews with people who themselves have immigrated as adults, but we're focusing on materials that would be a couple of generations removed from immigration, just as a kind of cutoff point. The third major linguistic and cultural area that's covered with the project are Native American languages, and I'll talk a little bit about that. It kind of links up with some of the things that Jane and Anne were talking about before. There are a number of other links that we'll have through this to similar kinds of projects, but there really is nothing like this as far as documenting indigenous, and when I say indigenous, I include not only Native American languages, but also so-called heritage languages, languages that are spoken by the descendants of immigrants, in some cases five, six, seven generations after immigration. The idea is also not to just simply put out material that's of interest to a narrow group of linguists, but to people across disciplines, especially American history, American studies, but not only scholars, to community members. It's very important for us, in the spirit of our outreach programming and the Wisconsin idea, to disseminate interesting information to the general public. And so our evaluation metric has been very much focused on getting community members to let us know what they find interesting. And not only do we have the virtual portal of our website that's out there with an evaluation and comment section so people can give us feedback, we go on the road constantly, probably 8 or 9 major outreach programs per year, going to community groups, small local libraries, heritage organizations, public schools, senior citizens groups, the whole gamut. And then present certain excerpts of material that we find interesting and then use them as a kind of catalyst for information of that we can go back to our archives and say, oh, people find this interesting. Let's see what we have on that. Now, speaking in fairly general terms about the progress and overall outcomes and impacts of the grant, on the digitization side, we've exceeded our expectations. We completely digitized all the German and English dialect holdings that we had. And also within this idea of leveraging, as soon as the digitization project was underway, that inspired people who had, individuals who had collections of their own, or retired scholars from other institutions, people in Europe, for example, who also had sound recordings that they had made, that inspired them to loan the materials to us, in some cases donate, but in most cases loan the materials for permission to make use of these materials and disseminate them on the web. And in return, they got, like, obviously had their originals returned if they wanted that, and then they also got digitized copies. So it was a great way for them to digitize their materials. In most cases, these materials were languishing in people's basements, libraries' basements, these kinds of things. Most of it on reel-to-reel tape. Luckily, very little of it had been degraded, so we were very, very fortunate to have good material to work with. So as I say, the amount of digitization that happened exceeded our expectations, and that's something that's really obviously a very, very important basis for future work. Then we also, of course, created our website, which is this sort of, you know, ever-expanding portal that's in this loop of feedback. As I say, we have this evaluation that's built into the website. We had extensive work with focus groups before the website even went online. And we're constantly, as I say, going out into community groups and networking with especially teachers and leaders of heritage organizations to determine those things that they find most interesting, and then we aim to respond to those needs. And again, speaking about the extensive public outreach project, based on the digitized materials, personally go on the road, do PowerPoint presentations, bring my iPod with me with sound clips on there, pop open a little dock, right, that you can put your iPod in, and usually the sound quality is excellent for even fairly large-sized rooms, and then just go to town playing these clips. Interpreting, you know, supported with PowerPoint slides that will give either transcriptions, translations, or just simply interesting images that highlight the content. And in the process, this is something that we've had sort of a preliminary discussion, Liz, Jane, Anne, and I, before this session, the idea of, you know, linking this to a notion of cultural stewardship. And before we were even, you know, the term cultural stewardship did not come up at all in our grant proposal, but as we on the sort of grant team thought about this, we were realizing it's like, yeah, along the way, in this kind of loop of interaction that we have, not only between ourselves and scholars who are making this material, but especially to community members and independent scholars, we find that we are developing kind of on the ground this notion of cultural stewardship, determining what things are worth preserving and what things are of particular interest. Those things are maybe of greater interest to us than to other members, and realizing that there's a real multiplicity, a diversity of opinions about what is valuable and interesting. And trying to please everybody at the same time is not an easy task, but I think so far we're doing fairly well. Now, the one big challenge that we've had in the project has been building relationships with the Wisconsin tribes. And this has to do with some of the issues that, for example, Anne talked about. Many of the tribes, for example, in our immediate area in Wisconsin are very, very small on the language side of things. Very, very few of the indigenous languages are spoken. The Menominee tribe, which is the tribe that we have the closest relationship with, there are approximately 12 speakers of Menominee left in Wisconsin, and about 6 of them don't feel like talking. In other words, literally not talking about this, because language, culture, spirituality, all these things are interspersed with one another, and so it's not just about where the verb is, you know, positioned relative to the subject, right? But it's about the content, what is being transferred with these languages. And a lot of the elders, for example, have basically resigned themselves even within the tribe to saying, when I die, that's it. And I don't care whether the light is extinguished. There's no way that we can maintain this. So why do I need people from the UW-Madison to come in and sort of, you know, then, you know, with pith helmet style, disseminate this globally? So it's been a very slow process. We have made progress, but it's a very slow process to build trust. Along the way, we've discovered it's very, very important to work with tribal colleges. Most of the major tribes in Wisconsin actually have community colleges, and there are two, as a matter of fact, on the Menominee Reservation. So it's, and there are projects there to preserve and to actually promote the language on some of these on some of the reservations. We've also had a couple of students from the Ho-Chunk tribe, which is actually the numerically largest tribe in Wisconsin, also known as the Winnebago Indians, who have come as students to the UW-Madison and are studying linguistics and anthropology and are getting into sort of, you know, things from our side of things. So as a kind of short-term solution, we decided, you know, on the Native American side to take material that's out of the German and the English dialect recordings that deal with Native American content and then foreground that, right, to sort of show, you know, the native, non-native interactions, and that's one thing that I'm going to be excerpting for you in a moment. Just to give you a sense of the overall portal appearance of the website, focusing now on the German side, which is the one side that's the most developed. We do a lot with clickable maps so that you can roll your mouse over and click on a state and then be able to zero in on a particular state. Then we get into a state, then you're able to zero in on a particular county. So rollover maps are very important for us. We do a lot of things in terms of classifying them, not only in terms of geography, but in terms of the dialect origins. So in the case of German dialects, where the source dialects would have been in Central Europe. The three major areas of German dialect as a heritage language in the United States are the greater Pennsylvania area. Pennsylvania Dutch is the oldest and the largest of the German heritage descended languages, Wisconsin and Texas. And German ethnicity, you may know, is actually the largest single ethnicity of any ethnicity in the United States. And so more people claim German descent than any other descent. And it's not no surprise that the German language has been the heritage language that has been maintained more significantly, really, than any other language beyond immigration. You'll notice also at the bottom there that we have, and I cut it off because there's not enough room just on this, but the web page goes down below. You can search by states just sort of descriptively, and then we have a number of interpretive essays that go that link together common themes that are important for especially non-scholars to make sense of the information. Then looking down lower on the screen, you see that we have things broken down by state. So the states that we have covered so far as clips that are available, I should say that these clips are all in the neighborhood of, say, 1.5 to 5-6 minutes in length. They're MP3 files. The original files are in WAV format. We'll also have, by the end of the summer, a very, very large database that has all the recordings listed in there. But for reasons of storage and that's server capacity, we will only feature just individual clips as kind of little tastes of the material that we have, selected for not only their linguistic interest, but especially for their content, right? So we have a number of things down there from Wisconsin, and then you can see some of the different kinds of essays that we have. And here's an example of the beginning of one essay. So one thing having to do with German, the terms high and low are quite familiar, but often misunderstood. Even among community members, they say, well, what do you speak? Well, I speak a low German. Well, what does low German mean? Well, it means a very different thing to linguists than it does to just sort of average folks. So we interpret that. And then you have, for example, a map of showing areas of German settlement in Wisconsin. German is the buckle of the German belt. Wisconsin is the buckle of the German belt in North America. 60% of the Wisconsin population has some connection to German ancestry. Milwaukee would be the jewel on the buckle of the German belt, I guess. That's the most German city in North America in terms of ethnicity. And then we have just some cool images there. There's a tavern hall, a meeting hall in Watertown, Wisconsin, where I used to live, that was called the Plattdeutscher Hall, which means literally the Low German Hall. I'm walking down the street, and I said, that's cool. And it's the home of the Low German Club that still meets. It's celebrating its 150th anniversary this spring. Now, going back to sort of the historical origins, and basically we'll find all these things for the other heritage languages that we document, as well as the dialects of regional English. So you'll be able to go back to, say, southwestern England, other places in the British Isles, to see where the roots of some of these American dialects lie. And here we have another example of a map that has a certain amount of interpretive information, just fairly bare-bones descriptive, giving terminology. This happens to show the major dialect areas in the expanse of the former German Empire. And you'll notice that at the upper right there, you'll see, I sort of paused it there, it says Marathon County Pommersch, right? Pomeranian dialect is spoken in Marathon County, which is located in central Wisconsin. So you can roll your cursor over this map and then also see which North American German dialects in this case, or English dialects, or whatever other heritage language you have, where the closest descendant would be, a linguistic cousin. And then that takes you right to the sound files. And here's another list also of another clickable map where you can go right to the state and then click on a county. And then you have a little inset up there of the source, European source dialects. Now, for the Native American languages, obviously we don't trace the origins back to Europe, but because Native American populations have been on the move in many ways, you know, just as in such a complex way as we find among the heritage groups, you'll also find things like here's the Algonquian ancestral homeland, so to speak. We just saw something about the Potawatomis before. The Potawatomis, of course, have their origins in the upper Mississippi area and certainly including in Wisconsin and now Michigan. Okay, we're wrapping up at the end. Yes, I see the time. I'm summing up. And here's an example of the last images that I'll share with you. This is an example of how the sound clip layout is set up. You can click on the MP3 file there. There's a brief commentary of information that's particularly interesting about the sound clip and something about the speaker. Speakers' identities are preserved unless they're people of sufficient note that their identity should be revealed. And then on the right-hand side, you find a translation or a transcription of the material, depending on the language or dialect. So the last thing I'm going to leave you with is I'll just kind of zero in, and you'll listen to this recording. This was a woman who's no longer living. She was born in the late 1890s. She was a school teacher from this Marathon County, Wisconsin, a speaker of the Pomeranian dialect. Very interesting because Pomerania, does not exist anymore. It's a part of Germany, the German Empire, that is now part of northern Poland. There are effectively no Pomeranians living there. And she's talking about early contacts between Germans and Indians in her area.
Ja, aber nur wenig, sehr wenig. Mein Vater sagt, dass öfters Winters, dann hat er weg, wie er im Busch ein Wintercamp hat. Und er hat eine Curve gemacht für Elm, Slippery Elm. Und dann hat er so die Curve aufgebracht und hat er sich da Entenfeuer tuscht. Brot oder was wird am Enten ist. Aber er hat öfters auch Hirschfleisch gebracht. Aber sehr viele Inches sind nicht west hier. Gerade hier in diesem Town sind auch ein paar west. Aber die Einfamilie ist sogar, die Jungen sind in der Schauljahr. Aber sogar der Schaulehrer, der hat Angst hat vor dir und hat alles da, was er nur kann, damit er nicht in der Schau kommen soll.
The last image I'll leave you with is an example of the kinds of things that we take on the road. This is a Ho-Chunk woman, and the Ho-Chunk tribe was the group that would have been that lived in Marathon County historically. This is a Ho-Chunk woman from the image taken from the early 20th century, and behind her are baskets made of slippery elm. I found this in the Wisconsin Historical Society, so it's a kind of a cool image that relates very directly to the content. And with that, I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Okay, do we have a few questions? We've got about 7 minutes for questions. I know you're pooped. It's a long day. Martha, Ms. Baca.
The third speaker spoke about the importance of language, and the first two speakers, I know this is a really big deal. Jane, when we used to work together on thesaurus and vocabulary. So can you just say a little bit about what you're doing to provide additional access points, even for the variant spellings of Potawatomi and all the different variations of calling the objects and so forth? Could you say a little bit about that?
Who wants to go first? Go ahead.
Can you hear me? We do have various dictionary projects. The largest one is the Menominee Dictionary Project, and we're hoping to make that completely accessible online. But this is something where it's sort of a consortium of Native American linguists, both in the sense of like Native Americans who are linguists as well as linguists who work on Native American languages, and the tribes themselves and language teachers in the community colleges. So that's something that's definitely a major priority for us.
Language is a priority for our museum, but perhaps I just want to say that perhaps some of the most interesting work on language preservation is being done by my colleague Rob Leopold at the National Anthropological Archive, who has support from the National Science Foundation for language preservation. We do some sound recordings, but not a lot. It is something that we've investigated and not done a lot of. So I wouldn't say that we have a lot of expertise in language preservation right now at all. We do and record and will work at holding multiple versions, multiple spellings, multiple terms, native terms of objects, our own versions of names of objects, so that our systems will try and encompass, rather than a right term, wrong term concept, or preferred term concept, I think we'll probably, for many things, have multiple terms so that people can see what terms are used.
Other questions? I wanted to ask a question of Mark. As you're creating a lot of digital data, and you've been sitting here all day listening to us talk about preserving this data, what are you doing about making sure that these objects, these digital resources, will be here for a long time? Because this is a tremendous amount of work that you're going through.
It is. As far as the originals, the masters, most of which are on reel-to-reel, I was intrigued by the morning session. We were talking about the virtues of cold, dry storage. In the building that the Moxcada Institute occupies, which is actually the oldest building on the UW-Madison campus, it's an old farmhouse that was built in the 1860s. We have a root cellar.
Oh!
So it's relatively cool. And we got a couple of dehumidifiers running in there. It's not ideal as far as the preservation of the tapes are concerned. So what we've done is, kind of in the spirit of locks, is make as many virtual copies, so basically DVDs and CDs, and put them in as many different locations. We have not made the mistake of putting them all in the sound lab with the originals, but having them at various offices on campus, as well as actually outside of Madison, too. So if something bizarre were to happen to the entire city of Madison, we would have backups there as well.
Okay, so you're still in the DVD-CD mode.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes.
Liz?
Yeah.
We have about 4 terabytes of images. All of our, as part of our move, we digitally imaged all of our objects, about 20 megabytes an object, and we've imaged the catalog cards, and we've scanned about 25,000 of our 80,000 photo archives. And so we have an EMC storage device with about 21 terabytes of storage capacity. We have it mirrored to our museum on the mall from the CRC. We have a modern tape backup that can back up the whole system, but we also have the ability, we have an optical media device that holds about 800 DVDs so that we have copied the data to DVD, and then we've sent it out to Iron Mountain Storage. Mm-hmm. We do believe in multiple copies in multiple places, mm-hmm. Multiple versions, but we have basically put in multiple copies of significant amounts of data mm-hmm. for ourselves. And one of the things we thought about and why we went to, again, a DVD concept was when you have an image, it's not like a Word document. You have the image, and you press it once, and so that it's not going to change on you. People change images, but they make new copies of those images as they're used in mm-hmm. various derivatives. Mm-hmm. And so we found that the ability to create DVDs and move them off-site has been very helpful to us. And then we have basically the 5-year migration period, and we can also... because we hold all our images in an online format, we can migrate them from system mm-hmm. to system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Your content DM.
Yes, yeah. We are content DM. We are, all of our stuff is basically born digital. Like I said, the artifacts have all gone back to the original owners. So they're TIFFs and a few other various and sundry standard formats, and we are saving them on DSpace, which is our digital repository for the institution. And that DSpace comes with our instance of DSpace, we are guaranteeing that things will be migrated over time if they need to change format. That is part of the administration of DSpace itself. So we also have multiple copies around. There's some in my department and some in the ITS servers, which is the IT servers. So there are some copies, but I think our safest bet is DSpace, which is, of course, rated and backed up offsite and all of that.
So it's on a server environment. Yeah. Okay, great. Other questions? All right. For those of you that are traveling home tonight, I wish you a good trip, and we'll see you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. I can't remember what time. Well, your notebook tells you what time continental breakfast is. For those of you that are staying here at the hotel and need dinner, the hotel and information tab in your notebook lists a variety of restaurants that you can have fine and delectable eating. So find a partner, find somebody that you'd like to have dinner with, and we'll see you all tomorrow morning. Thank you, and thank all the speakers for today.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.